incoming guest stated last April that in an official work memo, she likened the appointment of Scott Pruitt as the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency to putting Satan in charge of the Office of Faith-Based Affairs. Yes, she did, and you'll find out why soon. Hi, I'm Cher Tanner, Community Coordinator for the Pachamama Alliance Tampa Bay.
And I am Sharon Joy Kleitch with the Connection Partners here on WMNF, The Source, welcoming you to our show, Spotlight on Game Changers. We're all about creating positive connections in our world. Instead of discussing the problems you regularly read and hear about, our show is about the antidote to the gloom and the doom. Yes, we find brilliant people solving the most challenging issues facing us. Today, we're shining the spotlight on a woman who directs the environmental and climate justice program for the NAACP. Her goal is to uncover and implement creative solutions to these environmental and climate injustices. The purpose of our show is to enlighten you, inspire you, and ignite you to action. How do we do it? Our upcoming guest is our secret sauce.
We use as the backbone for our show the 10 qualities of a game changer developed by the Pachamama Alliance. They were inspired by cultural historian Thomas Berry's philosophy. He said that the great work of our time is to carry out the transition from the current period, which is a time where humans can be a destructive presence on the earth, to living in a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. These 10 qualities of a game changer should get us there. And we've discussed them in detail on our first show, which you can listen to on our Facebook page at Spotlight on Game Changers or on our WMNF homepage archives. These game changer qualities help us to choose our guests. And our upcoming guest, Jacqueline Patterson, is a living, breathing example of what it means to be a game changer in the world. In addition to her work with the NAACP, she is a co-founder and coordinator of Women of Color United, a network of individuals and organizations that brings together constituencies of over 50,000 women nationwide.
We regularly play an audio clip to set the stage and ignite the conversation with our guest. This upcoming clip explains environmental racism. Racism isn't just about police brutality or the criminal justice system. It's in the air and the water. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan is a textbook case of environmental racism. We explain how it's playing out across our country. Published by AJ Plus, here is the nearly 3-minute audio clip.
When we think of racial injustice, we think police brutality or the criminal justice system. But what about our air and water? Environmental racism. It's about policies and practices that discriminate against communities of color by making them live near landfills, sewage plants, and other polluting facilities. And while poverty has a lot to do with it, the leading environmental justice expert told me this.
Racism trumps class. Even middle-income African Americans are more likely to live in more polluted neighborhoods.
In fact, one study found that Black Americans making $50,000 to $60,000 a year are more likely to live in polluted neighborhoods than white Americans who make just $10,000 a year. Flint, Michigan is a textbook case of environmental racism. It's where 100,000 residents have been poisoned with toxic water contaminated by high levels of lead. Why? Because the state was trying to save a buck. Flint is around 57% Black, with 40% of its population living in poverty. Residents protested the dirty water for over a year, but were ignored. And that's how environmental racism plays out. Minority communities have much less political clout, so regulators can, and often do, ignore them. And not far from Flint is Detroit, where 83% of the population is Black. It's home to the most polluted zip code in Michigan.
Zip code is the most powerful predictor of health. And all communities and all zip codes are not created equal.
Southwest Detroit is surrounded by a lot of industry, like salt mining, steel production, tar sands oil refining, and coal burning. And that's meant that 1.6 million pounds of chemicals enter that community yearly. Not coincidentally, Wayne County, where Detroit is, has the highest number of children's asthma cases in the state. But look, environmental racism isn't just a Michigan story. It's an American story. Take, for example, Louisiana's Cancer Alley, an 85-mile stretch along the Mississippi River. It's known for its over 200 petrochemical plants and a high rate of cancer, mainly among Black residents. So, is there anyone protecting folks from environmental racism? Well, there's supposed to be. The Environmental Protection Agency has a special department called the Office of Civil Rights, but in its 22-year history, the office has never formally found a single case of discrimination. In fact, more than 90% of communities that make complaints find them rejected or dismissed. On top of that, the Guardian newspaper recently revealed that U.S. authorities across the country are deliberately distorting water tests in cities like Detroit and Philadelphia to minimize the reported amount of lead in the water. Environmental racism, while not always the most visible form, is also widespread. So, when is enough enough?
Jacqueline Patterson is the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Jackie has worked as a researcher, program manager, coordinator, advocate, and activist working on women's rights, violence against women, HIV and AIDS, racial justice, economic justice, and environmental and climate justice. This woman is all about justice. She served as a senior women's rights policy analyst for ActionAid, where she integrated a women's rights lens for the issues of food rights, macroeconomics, and climate change, as well as the intersection of violence against women and HIV/AIDS. She also served as Assistant Vice President of HIV/AIDS Programs for IMA World Health, providing management and technical assistance to medical facilities and programs in 23 countries in Africa and the Caribbean. She also served as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Jamaica, West Indies. Jackie holds a master's degree in social work from the University of Maryland and a master's degree in public health from Johns Hopkins University. So welcome, Jackie Patterson. We are so happy to have you on our show. I'm Cher Tanner, and I'm here with Sharon Joy Kleitch. And we want to just say welcome to Spotlight on Game Changers.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Appreciate you having me.
Well, I have been reading so much about you and watching all of your videos, and you're just such a brilliant woman, and I thought it would be great to start. It's National Women's History Month, and you certainly are a woman of history, and you've really dedicated your life to all the justices that are out there. I mean, it seems like you care about all of them. And we just had, as you know, International Women's Day, and their campaign this year is hashtag push for progress. So I thought it might be great to start with you, you know, tying in the environmental injustice to gender, specifically women, and how they're negatively impacted.
Yeah, so how women are negatively impacted by environmental issues, climate, and so forth.
Yes, and more so than men, you know. I mean,
yes.
From what I've been gleaning, women really are the ones that receive the greatest brunt of climate change.
Quite so, yes. And so, yeah, and really the whole climate change continuum, whether it's drivers of climate change, like the pollution that comes from power plants and other industrial activities, women are impacted by that in different ways because some of the pollutants that come out of those facilities include endocrine disruptors, which interfere with reproductive health for women. Mm. Also some of these plants and so forth are tied to some of the toxins that come from the plants are tied to breast cancer and other forms of cancer that uniquely affect women. And mercury is another toxin that comes from these plants, which is known to be tied to birth defects. And so on the driver side of the continuum, as well as, and then also when we look at the energy production, and particularly some of the out west where they have what they call man camps, where it's tied to the oil and gas drilling industry, particularly in North Dakota and South Dakota, where they have places where men congregate and they're not living with their families. They're just staying there during the times that they're drilling. And then they go home every few weeks or every few months or so. And so those man camps are known. They've been exposés on CNN and so forth to be dens for drug use and for trafficking. Mm. And in those contexts, you see a lot of missing and disappeared women, particularly indigenous women in those areas, because those are often that drilling is often done on native lands. And so, and women are trafficked. Women are have been engaged in the drug trade as a result, and then women have, as I said, been and disappeared as a result of those industries. And then on the other side, we have the impacts of climate change, including disasters. And it's a well-known, well-documented fact that women experience a spike in violence against women in the post-disaster context. So whether it's domestic violence or sexual violence, women have a heightened exposure to violence. Everything from the earthquake in Gujarat to the tsunami to Hurricane Katrina to the BP oil drilling disaster, it's consistent, the data around the spike in violence against women. So I could give you many examples, but those are just a few.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Women really do suffer. You know, I was watching one of your talks. In fact, I believe it was the one at Harvard, and you brought up the MLK idea around this triple scourge of militarism, mm-hmm. materialism, and racism. And then you also brought in his idea of the beloved community. And mm-hmm. I thought, like, starting there might give a great framework for our listeners as to the kind of work that you really concentrate on and have committed your life to, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when we address the impacts of climate change and the drivers of climate change, there are many levels at which we work to address the impacts and drivers. On the driver side, we might work to change the policies around the Clean Air Act, or we might work to close a specific coal-fired power plant and transition to clean energy. On the impact side, we might work to make the disaster system more equitable, or we might work to push for stormwater management systems and these kind of things. However, at the same time, we are bound to look at the systemic underpinnings of these disasters. And so in looking at the systemic underpinnings, we recognize that the triplets that Martin Luther King described of militarism, materialism, and racism are very much at play in terms of these challenges that we face. So whether it is the materialism and the quest for profits that make it so that we have systems that are commoditizing our natural resources and commoditizing people without any regard for environmental well-being or people's rights. And the fact that often people who are commoditized are the people who are people of color and or low-income people, and that's where we start to see racism play a role. And even to the extent that militarism and the kind of advancement of imperialism and the ways that nations have been taking advantage of, including the very colonialism and the murder of thousands of indigenous people in this land that we now call America, that was the beginning of that for this land anyway. And so there's just so many ways that we have that we've gotten on this path to catastrophic climate change that are tied to those systemic underpinnings. So we have to, you know, so while we're pushing to make things better for people of color through equitable policies and practices, we're at the same time looking to eliminate racism, while at the same time as we're trying to make things better for people who are poor, we have the goal to eliminate poverty. And while at the same time as we are trying to tweak the system of capitalism that that is responsible, because by definition it means that there's winners and losers. There's people who are capitalized upon and people who capitalize. And it tends to be people of color in low-income communities that are on the losing end of that equation. So in order for us to really see justice, we have to shift away from a capitalist economy that is literally predicated on the notion that people, that there's going to be people who are going to do very well and people who aren't going to do well at all. So that's where we see the need for systemic change as critical to moving forward.
And Jackie, I think that's a very profound quality and way you think who you are, is that you can tolerate the whole chaos of systemic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you pointed out, you get down one trail and, oh my gosh, there's something else.
Yes.
And how did you, as a game changer, move into that large systemic thinking? I know you were in the Peace Corps. Was there any experience down in Jamaica? Or I also remember about your tour, Women of Color Climate Justice Tour. What led mm-hmm. you into this systemic thinking that you're describing so well?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, as you said, it was really those experiences, because while I was in, for example, in Jamaica, you know, I was a teacher teaching special ed, mm-hmm. and I was teaching special ed to kids with special needs, obviously. And one of the so from right there, when I was, you know, in my early 20s, just fresh out of school, I could see right away that the reason that the kids who are all the 3-year-olds that I was teaching sign language to and their parents, there was a whole population of 3-year-olds who had a hearing impairment, and it was because of an outbreak of rubella that had happened 4 years before. And rubella for us is not even something we ever even talk about. Most people don't even know what rubella is, because we have our MMR vaccines that everyone just gets as standard practice. Mm. And most people don't even think about what the R even is.
Right.
And so something we take for granted that's just part of our, you know, course of daily living is denied to a place like Jamaica for this whole population of folks. And then you have these kids with these special needs as a result. And so right away I just saw, like, wow, I'm in a land of such opulence in some ways as it relates to the tourist industry. And then you have folks who don't have access to potable water and don't have access to indoor plumbing or these kind of things. And then I just saw, just, it was just so stark how everything from the macro finance, the system with people getting in debt to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and how that played out in terms of people not being able to get further in terms of their daily lives, and how that played into where people are paying fees and, you know, having to do what they call structural adjustment, and how that resulted in people not being able to provide these basic necessities like vaccinations that resulted in these very unequal conditions. So it was just as plain as the nose on your face when you're down there in the midst of all of that.
Well, telling about this, and I'm curious, which came first, your master's degree in public health at Johns Hopkins, or the experience in Jamaica led you there?
Exactly. It was the experience in Jamaica that led me there. It was my experience in seeing what I was seeing that made me think, okay, I need to, in addition to being a special education teacher, I need to go a couple steps back and think about how I can prevent some of these conditions that require all of this, you know, extra education and so forth. And so that's when I decided to come back and study public health, and then also study like these macro systems and how our political system ties to access to public health resources. And then I simultaneously said I needed to go to school for social work, and not as a clinical social worker providing counseling, but as a macro social worker doing community organizing, because I also saw right away that people needed to be in charge of their own destinies. And I really wanted to study how to do community organizing so that I can be a part of not only a systems transformation, but a people-led systems transformation.
We want to let our listeners know that we're talking with Jackie Patterson, who is the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. And I'm Cher Tanner here with Sharon Joy Kleitch on Spotlight on Game Changers. And Jackie, you know, it's amazing to me what you were just talking about, this systemic thinking. And I really think most people really don't get that it's all connected. You know, they don't have a clue really what environmental justice is, or what, how it could possibly hook up with climate justice. How do you educate people around that? I know this is a big part of what you do. So how do you take this out into the community to try to wake people up and really have this understanding of how one thing is totally linked to the other thing? And until we get down to the root causes, there will be no solutions, really.
Yeah. So to the greatest extent possible, I am working with communities so that they themselves are making these discoveries and having this understanding. And to some extent, these are communities that already have that understanding. And when I'm working with the communities, I'm helping to connect them with resources or models so that they can actually affect the change that they're seeking to actualize for their communities. And so sometimes it might be working with a community and having a visioning session with the community. Often with the NAACP and with other groups that are fighting for environmental justice and so forth, that there's more about what people are fighting against than what people are fighting, you know, what people are trying to advance as vision. So a lot of times I'm in communities and I say, okay, yeah, we have that landfill there, and, you know, we have this coal plant here, or yes, this disaster happened. And like, what do we want in terms of like, what would be an ideal for what is the beloved community to you? And then really going through and figuring out what is the barriers to the beloved community, whether it's the landfill or the coal plant or the disaster, and what are the assets that the community holds that they can build on, whether it's culture or expertise or whatever. And then how do we overcome the barriers, and how do we advance the vision? And usually through those conversations, there is already that knowledge, or there's a self-discovery. And just even opening up a conversation about vision sometimes really just unlocks things, that because so often communities are focused on surviving, the notion of thriving doesn't even seem to be in the offing. And so when you actually come in and you say, let's talk about vision, let's talk about imagination, people are like, wow, you know, it blows up open a mind that was closed by oppression and by suppression. Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, when I asked you that question, I mean, I loved hearing what you just said. I think that is magnificent, how you go into these communities which are struggling and suffering under these oppressive activities. I was really thinking more, though, in terms of how do we wake up the people of privilege? How do we wake up the people in power? How do we get them how do we touch their heart so they really get this true understanding of what is happening? Like when I was studying to be talking to you today, I sat reading all of the material feeling extremely guilty in my white privilege, you know? And it's like, what do we do? How do we allow people like myself to make a difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thank you for that. So for us, I mean, even though a lot of my focus is working directly with frontline communities and helping them to envision and lead on the change that they want to see in their world and in the world, there is a part of what I do which is speaking to people of privilege and helping folks to understand these realities that they're so separated from by geography or otherwise. And when I do that, it's really through a story-based strategy,
yes,
like really helping people to see what these stories are. And it, you know, so often, particularly these days, those stories result in tears because people had, and they'll come up and they'll say, I had no idea. And that's a sentence I probably hear them more than anything else. I had no idea. And these stories are irrefutable because they are stories, they are lived experiences. And I'm often showing video or images to supplement so that people truly see that there are these whole separate realities that they are not touched by in any way that they feel is, you know, that has been enlightening to them. But then in addition to through the stories, helping people to understand what's going on, and as a call to action, then I also help people to know what those pathways are to them making a difference. So whether it's in recognizing that still it really does need to be a people-led, like the people who are most impacted need to be in leadership. So I often will advise that folks then join their local environmental justice group, or if they're, for example, in a university, partner with a local environmental justice group, or you know, so however ways that people can actually engage so that they are led by the people who are most impacted. So that's one thing that I often say. And then I also talk about helping to tell the story as well, because, you know, like I said, I go around and I tell these stories and so forth, and people, but it can't continue to be that every time I tell these stories, people say, I had no idea. There needs to be more of an echo chamber.
Okay, right.
So we need to all take responsibility for popularizing these stories so that people actually do understand these multiple realities that are out there on this, in this planet and in this country. And so really helping to spread the word is an important role that people have as well. And then pushing for whatever change, even if one is like, one doesn't have access to an environmental justice group, have, you know, whatever changes one can have in one's own community. Because if, you know, whatever community, whether if you're living in a community of privilege, then you can get that entire community to shift away from fossil fuel-based energy by starting a community solar co-op. By doing so, you are helping that other community that is host to that coal-fired power plant or that oil refinery, because you're taking away the demand for the production of fossil fuel-based energy that is poisoning those communities and poisoning our planet. So whatever way that you can help to shift away from the system of pollution and extraction and so forth, any small way that or medium-sized way that one can do that in wherever one is an important step that people can take as well. And then I would also say that, you know, act with one's votes, really become educated about who are the change makers in our decision making spaces, and how can you make sure that they understand the stories and they understand what that means in terms of the impact of their policy making. One of the things that I show, because when I'm doing these presentations, often I will break up, you know, kind of telling these very maudlin stories with also doing something that kind of still gets at the truth, but like has a little bit of humor so that people aren't just weighed down. And one of the videos I show is a 350.org video about naming hurricanes after the policymakers who who are denying climate change.
I'm glad you brought up 350.org, because I've so enjoyed the richness in the interview in Yes Magazine last fall of 2017. I mean, just reading that itself, which people can link to and learn a lot. What I was curious about too, because these are great tools for other game changers taking notes today, Jackie. I'm curious about maybe some partnerships besides 350. You mentioned Johns Hopkins, and I'm wondering, I know you're based in Baltimore, you travel all over. Are there any programs that perhaps you partner with Johns Hopkins in public health and some of these activities, or if not Johns Hopkins, other medical facilities or medical directions that are partners?
Yeah, so a couple of examples of great partnerships include the Harvard School of Public Health partnered with Chicago around the two coal-fired power plants there, the Fisk and Crawford plant, and they partnered with the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, another group called PERO. And what they did was it was community participatory research and discovered that once they factored out other pollutants in the area, that the Fisk and Crawford plants were responsible for 40 asthma deaths and 1,000 hospitalizations per year. And through through working together to come up with that data, then the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, Alvejo, was able to use that data to go to the city council, first to go to the public to educate them about the real impacts of these plants that they didn't necessarily know, and then go to city council and say, here's some hardcore data that says what this is doing to our community. We need to get these plants to either clean up their operations were shut down. And so as a result, they were able to develop a clean air ordinance for their for the city, which was passed by the city council. And then the mayor gave an ultimatum to the to Midwest Generation, which controlled those two plants, to either clean them up or shut them down. And 6 months later, the Pilsen community in the south side of Chicago was free of the pollution from those two coal-fired power plants.
Excellent example. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
You are such a great, great storyteller, Jacqueline Patterson.
Thank you.
We would love to have you actually tell us one of the stories that you often do share when you're working with these communities of privilege that don't have the understanding about what's really happening. Can you share that with our listeners? Because I think they would find it very profound.
Sure. Yeah. So a couple of stories. I'll tell you two not so great stories and one story that kind of represents the way that we need to go.
Fabulous.
So starting with the two not so great stories, I was doing one of the cold-blooded campaigns or doing kind of a training around the health impacts of coal. And one of the folks, two of the folks came in late and they were like, yeah, as usual, we had to take our son to the doctor for his asthma. And they actually had a picture of the bag of medicines that their son was dependent on. And they also had a picture of him. And whenever I tell these stories, it's always very visual. So I'm describing the pictures that I usually show when I'm talking. So they also had a picture of him, and he was looking on as this little girl was playing in a fountain. And they said that the medicines and this image were kind of, emblematic of his life, because he, is bound to these medicines just to be able to keep his airways open so he can live from day to day. Mm-hmm. And that, but yet also within that, he is also limited in what he can do because of his asthma, because, he can't be as active as other kids. So that's why they showed the image of him looking while the child was playing in the fountain. He can't go to school like other kids because on poor air quality days, which for him living 2 miles away from a coal-fired power plant is all too often, he can't go to school like other kids. And then I also show in that same conversation an image of a school that's decrepit, because if you're living next to a coal-fired power plant, then on average your property values are at least 15% lower than other folks. And we all know that property values is what finances our school systems and the public school systems.
Right.
And so you have kids who are having a hard time paying attention in school because manganese and lead or some of the other toxins that come out of these plants. you have kids who aren't able to go to school like other kids because of poor air quality days and so forth. And then you're in an under-resourced school. And then the last picture I show is of a child standing on a milk crate being fingerprinted. Because if you're not on grade level by the third grade, you're more likely to enter into the school-to-prison pipeline.
Oh,
and so for us, this is where we see all of the social justice issues interconnected with these environmental issues.
Mm.
And so that's, and this is the reality of so many kids across this country. And you know, we kind of have labels like low performing or all these other labels, but the kids are a product of their environment, literally.
Yes.
And these environments have so much stacked against their success.
Right.
And yeah.
Well, I remember that story of the boy you told about the asthma. That was in Indiantown, Florida.
Exactly.
And our coal plant up there. And since Sharon and I are thinking Florida and where can we have an impact, we really want to support your efforts, not only in Florida, but specifically if there are any other situations going on in Florida or in Tampa Bay. I know I first heard you when you were at the opening panel at the USF St. Petersburg talking about social vulnerability and was struck with what you spoke as you're expanding upon today. So are there any situations going on in Florida that fit in with what you're describing that we might address?
Let's see. So another situation in Florida that when I went to Florida in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, there were so many situations. But one was visiting the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Okay.
And yeah, and all the folks there who were over the time since I, you know, that I was there visiting back and forth, that they had a much lower access to the resources that were being given out, or you know, or the information that was being shared, because of both language barriers and also immigration issues and challenges around, particularly as we have this kind of more punitive, more restrictive immigration climate that's going on. The notion of people's help seeking is restricted by a fear of the authority, so to speak.
Sure.
And what it could mean. I mean, people who have been legally in the country for decades are now facing deportation with this kind of crackdown in immigration policy. So all of that got, you know, pretty tied up in the extent to which people were actually getting help in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. And similarly, I was in another community that was primarily a Haitian community, where again, it was some weeks after the Irma, and people still had blue tarp and just water dripping literally into the home that they were living in. It was unbelievable, and a number of people hadn't, especially with the threat now of the removal of the temporary protective status for people from Haiti, and the threat of it at that time, and now the actual confirmation of it, people were very reticent to engage with FEMA or other people who are the only ones available to provide assistance in those situations. Those are multiple communities that were facing those kind of challenges. So we have kind of both, you know, coal plants being the biggest driver of greenhouse gas emissions that drive climate change, particularly carbon dioxide emissions. And then on the other side of the continuum, these communities that are impacted by the disaster wrought by climate change. I mean, Florida really stands at, you know, really kind of is at ground zero for both drivers and impacts in so many ways.
To say the least, I live on the beach here, and we watched one hurricane just pass us by and lost 5 feet of our beach. It just totally disappeared. I mean, we are in a very vulnerable state of affairs, and it it's quite shocking that our governor does not allow anyone in his staff to talk about climate change or global warming. So as you spoke, we need to change who we elect if we want to see changes made. And I have to tell you, we started the show today, which was kind of amusing, actually, with your analogy about Scott Pruitt and Satan. I heard that and I laughed so hard. I said, this is a great way to start the show. And so I thought maybe you might like to just say a few words. We're getting near to our time to wrap it up here about, you know, the need for people to go to the polls and vote for change.
Yeah, well, right. So that's definitely that is definitely the case. So whether it is these kind of decisions that are being made to pull back protections for various communities like the Alaska Native community that, or the temporary protective status for people from Haiti. And then at the same time, we're opening up the floodgates literally for, you know, offshore oil drilling, which I know is a challenge in Florida, and the unfettered pollution where we have places like Jacksonville in Florida that is already in the top worst cities as it relates to air pollution, according to the American Lung Association. And who we're putting in office is looking to make that even worse, if one can even imagine. And so so whether it's these kind of things, or we put out a report last year called Lights Out in the Cold, Reforming Utility Shutoff Policies as If Human Rights Matter. So whether it's the extreme heat that I know Florida experiences, or the extreme cold that folks in the north are experiencing, you have people who are literally paying the price of poverty with their lives when they get their electricity shut off, or get their heating shut off, and who we elect, whether it's to the Public Utilities Commission or to our Congress, are people who are voting on policies to whether to protect people from the elements. I mean, such a basic human right. And meanwhile, right, you have utility company owners who are making money hand over fist. And unfortunately, they're the ones who are supporting the people who are in these offices. And this is why we have them making decisions against the well-being of the people. So we really need to get out and vote so that we can demonstrate to policymakers that it's not just about who's putting money in your pocket, that you're being in or out of office really lies with the people, not with the profits of polluters.
So, I love that. I really do. Yeah. Let me ask you before we wrap it up here, I know Sharon Joy sent you the 10 qualities of a game changer, and hopefully you had an opportunity to look at those. Did any of them resonate with you? And don't say all of them. I know they all probably did, knowing you, Jackie. But did any really jump out at you and just touch your heart and say, that is me?
Yeah. So speaking of all of this work that I described, I sent you guys an email that I think you didn't get, stating that there was no way I was going to have time to open that attachment.
That's okay. You have told us tons and tons of amazing things that are happening as a result of the work you're doing, and you've given us so many great suggestions on how we can go forward. So how can people reach you, Jackie Patterson, if they want to help you there at the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program, or around your Women of Color United organization? What's the best contact information?
Yeah, so certainly folks can reach out to me via email. That's definitely the best way, which is jpatterson, PATTERSON, at naacpnet.org. That's naacpnet.org. That is by far the best way to reach me.
Great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Sure. Well, we hope that you receive lots of positive comments from our listeners, and we really want to continue supporting your work, Jackie. So please stay in touch with us and keep us posted on what's happening and when you're next coming to the Tampa Bay area.
Will do. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch, here with Cher Tanner, hosting our show, Spotlight on Game Changers, on WMNF, The Source. You've just heard from Jackie Patterson and can learn more about Jackie's work at naacp.org/issues/environmental-justice. And she can be reached at jpatterson@naacpnet.org.
Okay, Sharon Joy, what a fantastic experience being with Jackie. I'm so glad that you found her. She is just a remarkable woman. And you know, one thing we didn't really get into because she was unable to open the file, sadly, was the 10 qualities of a game changer. And so I thought it might be interesting for you and I to just kind of consider a little bit where we think she might have found the greatest resonance. And right out of the gate, I immediately go to that you recognize the systems of power and privilege.
That's was where I went to, Cher.
Yeah, I mean, that's just at the heart of all of her work. And then, of course, you take action that strikes at the root, because that really is what she's doing. She's getting down to right down to the base of where all the problems and issues are, and working so actively with the people that these issues are affecting so dramatically.
You know, Cher, each of us have gifts, and I find that Jackie's of recognizing the systems of power and privilege are an incredible combination to applying it. Some people recognize, write about it, and so forth. Jackie recognizes and applies it. So she takes the action to get at the root. And then number seven, putting forth a new story. I'm really struck by Jackie's skills in storytelling.
I know, yes. She's
part of a group of storytellers. Let's see, what's it called? The Center for Story-Based Strategy. So she does hit a number of the marks of the game changers.
And it is so powerful to have those stories, because when she told the story of the little boy and the mother showing all the medication and that he has to look out the window and watch other little children playing and he can't go to school because of the air quality, and it's just such a sad idea that we're allowing this to happen to all these magnificent young people that will never have the opportunity to reach their full potential. And so here she is, a person going into these communities and helping them to visualize and vision a whole new way of living.
Yes.
I thought that was just a beautiful concept, that she goes in and gives them something that they've never had before, this sense that we can live in a different way, and helping them to actually recognize that and then start to accomplish that.
I think the concept that I was taken to when she called using our imagination, I think of our Florida peninsula and Disney. So the imagination of Florida as a Disney place to start and jump into a new vision. As we bring this National Women's History Month show to a close, we want to tie in the issue of climate change, environmental justice, and gender together through this next 2.5-minute clip published last year by the Natural Resources Defense Council. It asserts that women have every reason to want to solve climate change because they're suffering the most from the consequences. A healthy environment is a basic right for all of us, regardless of where we live, how we vote, our gender, or what we look like. Here is Women and Climate Change.
Some people might not be aware that climate change and its effects really impacts women especially hard. Women are disproportionately experiencing more poverty than men worldwide. They have access to less financial independence, and they're also less able to bounce back in terms of jobs and training opportunities after climate disasters. New Orleans is a helpful place for us to look to understand the realities of climate change impacts on the ground. 83% of single mothers were unable to return home after Hurricane Katrina for a full 2 years after the storm. It's estimated that two-thirds of jobs lost after Hurricane Katrina were lost by women. After a disaster, often the best and only jobs available are in construction and rebuilding efforts, which are traditionally male-dominated fields.
While all of us are affected by climate change, some people are more vulnerable, and that includes women and kids. Take heat waves. Those are being fueled by climate change. Children spend more time outdoors playing. They're more vulnerable, more susceptible to heat-related illness. Pregnant women, they and their fetuses, their babies-to-be, are at risk for low birth weight. Climate change is affecting the range of insects that can carry diseases and also the period of time that they're active. It's making the range and that season bigger and last longer, and that puts women and children and older people at greater risk. So while women are great at connecting the dots between climate change and its effects on health, we right now are largely left out of the leadership globally to make a change in the way we get energy and moving toward a clean future. That has got to change. There's got to be more equity.
In a study of 130 countries, it was found that when women are in government positions, they're more likely to sign on to international treaties that are taking action against climate change. Women play critical roles in our communities, and our voices must be heard for climate action. In order to have a resilient future, women must have a seat at the table.
Perhaps you're ready to run for a seat at the table, or at the very least, support solid female candidates for office. I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch, looking forward to our next time together.
And I'm Cher Tanner. We want to acknowledge our engineer, Ira. He goes to great lengths to make us sound professional, poised, and polished. And we must honor the magnificent artist, Eliza Gilkison, whose exquisite voice and music, Beautiful World, brings us in and out of your lives. And we want to especially thank you for listening to our show, Spotlight on Game Changers, here on WMNF, The Source, Community Conscious Radio. And we hope to find you out there in the community this week, being game changers.
Beautiful trees, breathing the air alive. Beautiful bees moving from flower.